Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at decodingtv.com. Become a paid member and get ad-free episodes and early access to episodes. Thanks to everyone at decodingtv.com who makes this podcast possible.
I'd like to take just a second and make this about me. A lot of people have been asking about my arm. It's actually my shoulder. And I think tonight is a perfect time to tell everyone that Kieran Culkin beat the shit out of me.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Decoding TV, a weekly television podcast. I am David Chen. Joining me today, as always, he is Patrick Klepek. Patrick, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing great.
Welcome to our new weekly format. It's a big inflection point for the podcast. For years, Decoding TV has decoded weekly TV shows like Westworld, The Last of Us, Succession, and The Curse. We have loved diving in depth into these shows, analyzing them, and sharing our theories. But doing the podcast this way had a fatal flaw. People mostly didn't listen to the podcast if they weren't watching the show.
We might have, you know, and really dug ourselves a hole with The Curse.
Also, there are some shows we want to talk about, like Twisted Metal, that might not be dense enough to support a weekly recap podcast. So instead, we are launching with this new weekly format, and hopefully you feel more comfortable tuning in, even if you're not watching any specific show. Each week, we'll open by talking about one to two general topics about the world of television and entertainment. Then we're going to dive into some specific TV episodes we've watched that week. We'll put trailers when we bring up a new TV show in the audio. We'll also note the timestamp in the show notes so you can fast forward past that if you don't want to hear any spoilers for those TV shows. On occasion, we will continue to cover shows in the weekly recap format or via This Week in Streaming. But it is our hope that this weekly format will be the main engine of the podcast moving forward. So today on the podcast, we're going to be discussing the first couple episodes of Echo, the season premiere of True Detective Night Country, and then concluding with a conversation about the season finale of Monarch Legacy of Monsters. But first, we got a couple main topics. Up first is the Emmys, then afterwards, the state of the Star Wars universe. Maybe we'll squeeze in a little Marvel talk in there too, to join us for our conversation about the Emmys. He is the founder and editor, nay, visionary mind, behind the Substack newsletter Episodic Medium. Miles McNutt, welcome back to Decoding TV.
Thank you very much for having me on this inaugural weekly edition of this fantastic program.
You know, I was talking with Miles before the show about the struggles of trying to cover television, and he pointed out something that I don't even know why it hadn't occurred to me, that for something like The Curse, if people aren't watching it, a lot easier to get people to read an article about it than to listen to a podcast about it, because an article is like 5 to 10 minutes of your time. A podcast like an hour, and it's a different time commitment, you know, reading at Episodic Medium versus listening to Decoding TV.
I think a lot of people, definitely with that show in particular, were sort of like, what is going on? Like, truly, like, what is happening? I'm so curious. I have no desire to keep watching an hour of this every week because I'm bored, but like, I need to understand like what is going on as a point of curiosity. And so like, I saw a huge disparity between comments and likes where people were just like, I'm enjoying reading this. I'm enjoying reflecting on it. No desire to watch that TV program. And definitely probably not a desire to delve as deep as I'm sure y'all were.
Indeed, indeed. Well, Miles McNutt, let's talk about the Emmys, which aired last night as we're recording this right now. It aired on Monday night, the 75th annual Emmys. And apparently, according to the Emmys, there was approximately three shows on television, which won a number of awards. Basically, Succession picked up 6 awards the evening of the Emmys. The Bear picked up 6 awards during the telecast, and Beef won 5 awards. And that was most of the night, what I just said. were those three shows. Last Week Tonight won a couple of awards. And of course, there are other categories that also other shows won awards for, but that weren't broadcast at the 75th telecast. So those are the big stories. Was like Succession, The Bear, and Beef. Those are the big ones. I will say that it was a weird broadcast because obviously the Emmys were supposed to air this fall, but they got delayed due to the strikes. And so they were honoring work that had aired or broadcast often a year ago, often like even more than a year ago, right?
I think The Bear in particular is really relevant in this circumstance because like this is the first season of The Bear that was nominated for the award, which aired in the summer of 2022.
Yeah.
By definition. And so like particularly in the case of sort of Eben Moss Bachrach, who won for supporting actor in a comedy series for his role as Richie. If you think about it, in the first season of that show, would you look at that character and that performance and say, that is the best supporting actor in a comedy series on television? You would not do that in a single world. However, when they were voting on these awards and nominating people and thinking about this, I guarantee you every single Emmy voter who voted for him was thinking about season two of The Bear, which is eligible at the next Emmy Awards. So I fully expect that man is going to win an Emmy for the same performance twice. Like 100%. He's going to win again, and it's just how that's going
to
be.
You're referring, of course, to like season two episode called called Forks, which was like really amazing episode that he was the star of. But yes, the fact that it's like kind of like a cheat code where during the voting period, a whole other performance is airing on TV that everyone's talking about and people are voting on. So, yeah, it felt odd that we're honoring work that happened like 12 plus months ago. But other than that, I would say for an award show, it was an okay broadcast. Nothing went terribly wrong. It wasn't a disaster. It was fine. Miles McNutt, what did you think?
I agree with you on the broadcast. I think for the most part, it was actually short. Like later in the broadcast, Anthony Anderson was clearly vamping for time at one point, recapping what took place. Like they were running a couple minutes short. There was a bit towards the end where Tracy Ellis Ross and Natasha Lyonne were doing the I Love Lucy Chocolate Factory bit. And you could tell like that bit could have gone for 10 seconds and instead it went for a full minute. And it's because they literally just didn't have time. And I'm like, it was very efficient. I think the big kind of piece of the broadcast part we're talking about is the reunions of various casts across TV history, which I thought generally never went on too long. I felt like each one kind of felt like it was well-paced and well-situated and was always part of a presentation. So it always felt like it was kind of keeping the award show moving forward. I think it was generally an amiable way to spend 3 hours, which is not always the case.
Absolutely.
When we're talking a major award show.
Could have been a lot worse. And yeah, they wanted to celebrate the 75th anniversary by saying, hey, look at all the TV that's happened in the last 75 years. Now, I do want to say that many of those reunions were tinged with sadness for me personally, because most of the shows that were honored in those reunions, like Cheers and Martin and Grey's Anatomy and The Sopranos, are of shows that lasted longer than five seasons, which almost never happens right now because of the streaming environment and the way the financial incentives are built. You can count on maybe two hands the number of Netflix shows that have gone over five seasons. So it's like celebrating this time of past. Remember when everyone used to watch TV and TV used to be good and ran for many years and was a big part of our lives? Not really that much anymore. You know, like it's celebrating this moment that's passed. Patrick Klepek, you're not typically a fan of these award shows, you know, but you checked out significant parts of the program last night. Curious, what was your reaction?
Usually my interaction with the Emmys is having to set up an iPad so that my wife can watch all of the red carpet stuff while she is on her phone furiously texting back and forth in a group chat as they, I mean, judging might not be the wrong word to use, but you know, like that is usually my, it is like making sure that she has her setup so that she can do that for, I mean, she doesn't like the Golden Globes, the Emmys, like that's like her big moment with a bunch of her friends is to watch all that stuff. But what I thought was really interesting about your point, David, is if you try to imagine doing the recreation, like getting groups back together, get cast back together, very common. We see this happen in all sorts of different types of award shows.
Oscars, Golden Globes, it happens,
If you try to imagine, what would it do 30 years from now, right? What are the shows that would even, like, they still have eras to go through, right? Like, Game of Thrones, you could do it.
Yeah.
The Office, Parks and Rec, like, there are still eras ahead of what they're celebrating that fit that traditional TV format where a show becomes part of your life, where it be like these characters are central to how you think about how you spend your time and you form emotional bonds. The kinds of shows that qualify for that these days are really rare. Like Stranger Things, probably, you know what I mean? Like is one that maybe meets that
Stranger
moment.
Stranger Things and Succession maybe, but like Succession, not even a close to a phenomenon as any of the other shows that were mentioned that
Stranger
night,
Things is a pop culture hit to the degree that you would know who these people were and they would grow up. Like you could see and envision that. Succession is a critical darling. Nobody watched that show. I mean, people watched that show, but like in the grand scheme of things.
Millions of people watched that show. Yeah.
Right. So, right. And so just, I think it comes at a very interesting inflection point in not only to your point about how long shows are on, the relationship we have with those shows in our lives, but then, you know, peak TV as a concept is sort of crumbling before our eyes as the consolidation happens in streaming, in television production. It just makes me wonder, what are you celebrating in? Like, television will continue to be around, but the format in which we indulge in it, we consume it, we memorialize it, I think all of that is fundamentally shifting, even if we won't feel it for, you know, a decade from now.
Absolutely. Completely agree. Changing the topic slightly, you know, Miles, one of the things that has been brought up that I've already brought up is how few shows were honored during the evening. This is a constant problem. Alan Sepinwall wrote about it at Rolling Stone and how there's not very many solutions to it. Like you could increase the number of categories. So there's drama and there's comedy and maybe you could say dramedy category, you know, like you could increase the number of like overall categories people could submit things for, or you could force people to watch the shows, like watch more shows, but like that's difficult to do, you know. So the problem is there's so many shows that are so good, and then every year at the Emmys only three are honored or like four are honored in any significant way, and it makes for a boring telecast as well, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, like, and so I did go back and I was trying to figure out, because people were talking about how like, is this new or not, and it's like obviously in previous years we've seen shows like The Crown completely swept categories in year Succession was not eligible in the drama categories, and they're like, well, what else are we going to do? Moreover, Schitt's Creek swept the field in all of its categories in its final year, sort of this coronation. Was sort of like, wait, we didn't pay any attention to you for a long time, and now you're important because you went to Netflix. But like, these are the things that happened, right? But like, we have never had a year where three shows in all three categories have done what these shows did, which is sweep writing, directing, series, as well as at least two acting awards, right?
Yeah.
And like, none swept the field entirely. You know, Succession lost supporting actress. And Beef didn't win either the supporting awards, and The Bear wasn't nominated in lead actress this year because they were still playing the categories with the first season. But like, realistically, like, still, it felt like they only watched one show in each category, and for it to be that across the board, in past years we've seen splits in those areas. Like, you might be thinking, oh, well, did The Queen's Gambit or those types of things, but like, those years there were kind of other shows they gravitated towards, performances that stood out, leads that, but like, there was just none of that this time. And I think the frustrating part of it is that like, none of these shows are bad. Like, we can't be too mad about it. Like, it's not like we can be like, oh, that's the most boring thing they could have done. It's like, well, look, Succession, widely considered to be a great show. And also the fact that, like, you know, Snook and Culkin had never won Emmys before in those categories. So it's not as though, like, they were just rewarding the same people over and again, right? This is The Bear's first time. We can't be mad about it, even though it's just going to do the same thing next year.
But we want to be so mad about it.
But we want to be. And, like, same thing with Beef, where it's just sort of like, that's a fundamentally good show with two great lead performances. I think I would have been a bit annoyed, even though I don't really care that much about the people who won the awards, if they had won the supporting awards for roles that I didn't think were as substantial as the leads were. But ultimately, it's like, these are not like bad examples. This is not the Emmys treading in this like really boring water. It's just that
it's not like they nominated Obi-Wan or anything like that.
Do not get me started about what is by far and away the dumbest possible nomination I can think of. But like, I think at the end of the day, you start to realize like, okay, if we're not mad at the Emmys for like doing the boring thing, we're mad at them for just, they didn't watch enough stuff. They didn't think about these performances in context. They didn't like grapple with those things. But to your point, you cannot force the Emmy voters to do anything. The time where like they created blue ribbon panels that had to watch episodes of all the show people that were nominated and use that to build nominations was the year they nominated Kevin James for King of Queens. So we know that system doesn't work because it's just like, these are not the systems that we need. This is not the solution that we have. We're stuck in a scenario where it's just like the response to Peak TV from Emmy voters has been to narrow their sort of pathway of what they consider to be great and just kind of be like, it's easier. Why am I going to go try to do everything and make it from there? And so I think we have to ask ourselves some serious questions about, is this a matter of like trying to revitalize the Emmys, or should we just like stop pretending that it matters, right? To just sort of accept that like realistically we're never going to win this. Let's just accept it as the nomination is a victory. The chance for recognition is where it comes from. And as long as they're awarding good shows, can we really justify complaining about it?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And the broader question is, what is the function of an award ceremony and telecast like the Emmys in today's day and age? I posted on Threads last night how I thought the broadcast went okay. It was very unobjectionable, right? There's so many years where we watch a broadcast and we think that was a travesty. And this one was not. It was completely adequate. There were like very efficient, very occasional humor, a handful of great speeches. But I also said, hey, I wonder like what Gen Z thinks of, you know, Ally McBeal's tribute and the Cheers tribute and stuff. And somebody responded with something that I thought was very astute, which is, I don't think younger people watch award shows, right? And I think certainly a lot of the TikTokers I watch award shows, but like, I think there's many people coming up in the next generation for whom shows like this are just completely irrelevant. And I don't see them doing anything to try and change that, right? Award shows basically continue to have, like, so Golden Globes last week or like, a couple weeks ago, Emmys, probably the Oscars this year, they continue to just have the same format. And that format, I think a lot of people who are younger find pretty uninteresting. Patrick, clip back on here. I don't even both of you about this, but Patrick, what do you think about that? And Miles, curious about what you think about that as well.
Well, I think it's a measure of format, right? Like, I think a lot of people point towards something like in the space I work in, like the Game Awards is like, right. Do you just go full commercialization? Do you just turn this into sort of a trailer factory for what comes next? And then the awards are kind of sandwiched in between. I've covered
the
Game Awards.
Say what you will about the tenets of the Game Awards, Patrick Klepek, but at least it's an ethos is what I would say about that, you know?
And that ethos sucks, but like it is one. This year's Game Awards was the most miserable package they put together yet in trying to...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, saying they tried to balance the commercial and the artistic would be, I think, a very generous interpretation of how the Game Awards were packaged this year. But that's just putting sugar in... Like, that's just giving the audience a sugar rush. I don't know that it necessarily fundamentally changes the dynamic at the heart of... Because with the Game Awards, they're called the Game Awards, but it's... They're trailers. You're there for trailers and awards happen to be there. And so I don't know that the solution to the Emmys or the Oscars or any of these is necessarily like looking forward to stuff that you might be interested in. I think in many ways this speaks to just sort of like the fact that entertainment has become so scattered. Like we don't just sit down to watch TV. We don't just sit down to like go see a movie. Like all of entertainment has become this just sort of like really blurry line of like where we spend our time. And it speaks to Peak TV. It speaks to the rise of video games. Just people's interests is just scattered. And how many people, lots of people watch, probably lots of Gen Z watches TV, but do they just love the medium of television so much that they want to see it rewarded?
Right.
Probably not.
Or do they not even think about it in those terms at all? Right.
Like, I always feel like when I look at my kid interact with their iPad, it's like, she doesn't really have video game time. She might do a video game for 10 minutes and then bounces to something else. It's just, they have a fundamental different relationship with entertainment And I think that tension is then reflected increasingly over time with these award shows that are like hyper targeted, like, but you watched movies this year. And I just think younger audiences don't think of their entertainment time in the same way.
Right, right. Whereas yeah. these award shows were created in an earlier era when the arrival of the television set was a massive technological game changer, you know? So yeah, I think there's a lot to yeah. that. Miles McNutt, what do you think about just the basic concept of award shows in general?
Right. I've put a lot of thought into this academically. And like, I remember I asked some of my students at one point, cause I was just like, cause every time an award show happens, like I'll walk to class in an hour from now and just be like, hey, who watched the Emmys last night? And it's a joke. Like it's fully a joke, right? I know for a fact that none of them watched the Emmys. There's like 36 of them and the chances of one having done so is incredibly slim.
And these are people who have Miles as a professor and who have dedicated their right. lives to studying media in some
yeah.
capacity.
Now, mind
right?
you, they've been in this class for a week, so like they haven't yet been fully acclimated. But like one of the things about that conversation that will be very clear to me is like, but I sort of asked once, it's like, so for the people who do, like a couple people, what's going on? And like one of them was just sort of like, I watch award shows because like, and this was an African-American student, and they're just like, I want to see people like me be recognized, right? That the questions of diversity, the questions of inclusion were sort of front of mind to how they viewed award shows and the way they sort of understood them. And I was sort of like, that's an interesting answer to that question that reframes maybe how we think about what these award shows are, that they're a matter of visibility, right? That they're a matter of sort of creating this opportunity in those systems. But the thing is that like, A, there's, first of all, most of the time that's not what happens, right? We see cases like this year where Quinta Brunson's win, right? And the wins for Ali Wong and Steven Yeun, like we see some like meaningful diversity happening in these award categories, Ayo Edebiri, et cetera. But like some years it's just going to be a bunch of white people. So it's like, you're not going to get that every year yeah. from what you're looking at. But I think the important thing is like, I think the point Patrick makes about like, do people care about television? And it's just kind of like, the realistic point is that these award shows are for a group of people who grew up like this. Like David, mm-hmm. you mentioned sort of like being like an older millennial, a lot of these nostalgia beats, like we understood the Ally McBeal segment, right? We knew why they were dancing. We knew why they were in right. a unisex bathroom. Like those things could be like cultural reference points we could have. Gen Z watching that is surely was like, what the hell is going on with this particular case study? And I'm like, the reality of that is award shows are for an audience of people who are going to, like, it's going to die with us, like, truly and fully, right? I don't think that our cultural understanding of award shows is at all going to pass down. There's nothing I can do to pass that on to a younger generation. Like, and this is why, look, award shows, like, the Emmys in particular, so the Emmys are operating a carousel between the broadcast networks. And realistically, this carousel goes through 2026. And more or less, I think all the broadcast networks wish they had not renewed this contract when they last did. I think they probably wouldn't have done it if they had realized how much ratings would erode and how much every single broadcast network would get absolutely no nominations beyond like Abbott Elementary end of list, effectively.
That's a good
at this
point.
Moment
I hadn't
time,
thought about
right?
that.
So they are
it's
paying.
It's so humiliating. Ad. It's humiliating,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah. They are yeah. basically paying to broadcast their obsolescence in a very fundamental way. And so when the carousel comes up, they have to ask that question. Is this still worth it for us?
Right.
And the simple
right.
truth is it is worth it for exactly one broadcast network, and that is CBS. Why is it worth it to CBS? Because CBS has a captive audience, because their audience is old, and their audience will just turn on CBS on a given night because that's the channel that they have an affinity towards. No other broadcast channel still has that audience. And that's why when the Emmys like cycle back to CBS, the ratings always pop up. And it's always like, is this a sea change in how people see the Emmys? No, it's that people just watch CBS by default. And surely this is going to be the lowest rated Emmys, given the football competition that comes in January, given the fact that it was on Fox, which itself is a broadcast network, tends to draw lower ratings. Like
it was also on a Monday night, which is
it was
very
also,
bizarre.
The right? move to Mondays is sort of a longstanding issue of like, where do you put this thing when you don't want to compete against actual television, because no one's going to choose this over actual TV. The long and short of it is that like we're talking about something that matters so little culturally, and it is kind of clearly disintegrating, and yet its value to the industry is higher than ever. Mm-hmm. The industry cares about it more than ever. Like, you don't think it matters to FX that they just won their first comedy or drama series award with The Bear, right? That wasn't a huge accomplishment in their feeling of position in the industry. You don't think Apple is really frustrated that all that money they sunk into all those shows led to just like a Paul Walter Hauser win in supporting actor and nothing for Ted Lasso, nothing for those types of programs. Like, you don't think Netflix and HBO aren't still in a cosmic battle over these respective categories and sort of how they can play that out. The industry continues to care about this. And so the question is, like, where can they find a home that allows them to not matter to people, but where they can keep functioning and mattering to industry people?
How can we put it in like a nursing home equivalent of television where they can have their little fun and games, but that no one needs to watch them, basically?
Well, weirdly, you want it on a streaming service where you don't have to release any of the data. And then it can just exist. The articles will happen. The broadcast. Ultimately, what undermines a lot of this is the numbers are embarrassing. Like every year, year over year. But other than that, unless it's like the Golden Globes, where the actual production of the presentation is embarrassing, and that itself goes viral. Although maybe that's what you actually want, like these days, is just to have a disaster of a performance that makes people interested in it. But I mean, I think that is fundamentally it. But like, what are you going to do? Put it on? Just give it to Netflix, and then they broadcast. So,
for the record, the Screen Actors Guild Awards are heading to Netflix this year. They were on YouTube last year, but those used to be on cable on TBS and TNT. And effectively, they were like, this no longer matters to us. Like, why are we in this business? And so it was Netflix who stepped in, right? And it's kind of like, that's a huge test case for Netflix's ability to do live broadcasts, which that's gone great in the past. But also specifically their ability to just like use that as a value add for it to be something that invests those programs. But like, Netflix is so invested in award shows, it just makes sense, right? But we then take the Golden Globes, which went to CBS because, again, CBS viewers will watch anything. That's probably what happened. But like, the Golden Globes still exist because they were purchased by Penske Media, because Penske Media owns all the Hollywood trades that get all their advertising revenue from For Your Consideration campaigns. So you're now dealing with the Hollywood trades running an award show with historical precedent to subsequently drum up an awards race and For Your Consideration campaign that then ultimately lines their pockets. So the industry is so much incentive to keep award shows alive, financially speaking, and in terms of prestige and those types of systems. It's just kind of like, at what point do they realize that this is like a closed circle, right? Like that there is no like actual audience for this content beyond this sort of like small cabal. And it's like, in cases like the Emmys and things like that, okay, you find a streaming service, you find a way to kind of make this happen, that's fine. But like the Oscars have exactly the same kind of challenge attached to them. And in that case, the TV deals are the only reason the Academy is able to function. Right? Like you have to ask yourselves, if you're the TV Academy and you're trying to run these awards, you're an operation. They have scholarship programs, right? They have philanthropy efforts. They have all these things that the TV Academy does. How do they keep functioning if they're not getting these broadcast rights coming in the same way, or if the streaming deals that come in fall apart and they don't kind of function? Like, the awards can still exist, but as an institution, are we going to sort of lose whatever other value these organizations do in Hollywood or in these cases? I've been to the TV Academy and been part of like a faculty fellowship they used to do, but they also have like internship programs for college students where they'll pair you with industry mentors and kind of facilitate those types of programs. All those things probably depend on the revenue the Emmys generates. And so I do think that there's some other dynamics happening around those that kind of stand out in that case.
For the record, SAG is going to air on Netflix. SAG Awards, I should say, will air on Netflix on February 24th, 2024. So we will see how well that goes. I tried tuning into two Netflix live events in the past, the Chris Rock special, which went fine, and the Love is Blind reunion, which was a catastrophe. So I think it's fair to say they have a spotty record when it comes to live broadcasts, and we'll see how
the SAG. I don't know that people are going to be trampling down the internet servers to get to that one.
That's true.
I feel like
how dare might, you?
It's like,
how dare you?
Chris Patrick Rock, Love is Blind, SAG Awards. Hopefully, the engineers over there. I don't know if they'll be sweating that day.
Wow. Patrick, we're going to get a bunch of angry emails from the SAG people as a result of this comment. A couple of closing thoughts here. First of all, Miles, I like the idea of us needing to pass on generational knowledge of the award shows. You were saying how, it's going to die with us. And, no, Miles McDutt, we're going to be telling the kids, long ago, we used to stand on stages and give out envelopes to people, and they used to give long speeches full of names of people you didn't know. You know, like, we can be the ones that pass on the oral history of the awards, is what I'm trying to say. All right? All right? So it doesn't have to die with us. We can pass it on. But you're right. It makes absolutely no sense. it's ridiculous to pass something like that on. I want to bring up one last thing about this year's Emmys, which is the greatest disgrace of the Emmys this year, which is, I think we all know what I'm going to say, Better Call Saul, one of the greatest shows of our era.
Agreed.
Finished its run with zero Emmy wins at all after being nominated 53 times.
Infuriating.
A huge, huge bummer. Even at the Oscars, you know, say what you will about the Oscars, but oftentimes, you know, they'll like Jamie Lee Curtis. Okay. Like Jamie Lee Curtis won last year. She was awesome in Everything Everywhere All at Once, but like, was that really the best performance of that year? No, I don't think so. Right. No. Like, but they gave it to her because like she it often kind of serves as a lifetime achievement award. Like, hey, you've been doing this for so long. We want to honor you in some way. The Emmys, DGAF about any of that, apparently. Like, it's like they don't even want to. Obviously, they thought it was good enough to nominate, but not good enough to win, which is a huge shame. Miles McDutt, any thoughts on that before we end today?
I mean, look, there's a long lineage. People always point to The Wire as a show that never won an Emmy. But here's the thing. The Wire was also never nominated for Emmys. That's an important distinction, right? That part of what's happening here is that in part because we expanded the categories and the nominees within them, right? We now have a larger number of nominees in every category, meaning that there's more sort of range to happen in those respects. And given that in the midst of this, that we kind of have shifted towards these kind of dynasty logics where we don't mix things around as much, et cetera. I think you're just dealing with a situation where you just got to accept that they liked it. They never loved it. You know, they respected it, but never connected to it. Maybe the fact that it was a spinoff was held against it. Right. That in some way they're like, we spent all that time rewarding Breaking Bad. This is just a derivative case of that. So we're not going to give it as much attention. I think at the end of the day, you sort of have to sort of like, basically, again, we love to do this where it's like when the Emmys acknowledge something we love, right? Like where they pick up on a show where it's just like, yes, they finally understand, right? They're all there. They see what we see. You know, they're on the right page. But then like when they don't nominate things or they don't let things win, at that point we have to shift to the Emmys don't know what they're talking about. It's all a big popularity contest. They don't even watch the shows they're looking at. This is not an objective evaluation of anything that we care about in those respects. We just have to live with that. Like we just have to live with this truly depressing fact, with this truly unfortunate like bit of trivia. But ultimately, like when those situations pop up, just like Emmys don't matter, Emmys don't matter, Emmys don't matter. Like you just gotta drill it through your head.
That is one thing I'm gonna pass on. One day long ago, there was a show called Better Call Saul. And even though it was never honored by the Emmy voters, it was still brilliant. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Miles McNutt. Miles McNutt is the creative visionary and CEO of the Substack newsletter Episodic Medium. Be sure to check it out. Miles McNutt, thanks so much for joining us today at Decoding TV.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's move on to our next topic, which is there's going to be a Mandalorian movie, question mark? Patrick Lepik, tell us about this.
Kathleen Kennedy has spun the Star Wars movie wheel again and is tick, 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 tick. Oh, this time it has landed on reliable Jon Favreau, who, you know, was the showrunner. I don't know how he's credited exactly on The Mandalorian, but, you know, obviously a kind of chief architect of a lot of Star Wars's relevance, especially in television and Disney Plus with The Mandalorian and the several seasons that we've seen there. But the expectation had originally been we'd be getting a new Rey-led Star Wars film that kind of kicked off a new era of Star Wars that takes place after Rise of Skywalker. But instead, it seems like
maybe some season four scripts of The Mandalorian are being turned into a new film called The Mandalorian and Grogu, which is supposed to go into production this year. I don't think we have an exact date for when it's arriving, right. But Bob Iger is tapping his watch saying I think he's actually said that a Star Wars film needed to be in theaters by Christmas, 2025 or something like that. And it seems to be maybe this is a little bit of the impetus for why this film in particular is maybe being fast tracked.
Well, I think there's only one detail there that I'm not sure is 100% correct. And you're forgiven, Patrick, because at this point, the number of movies they have announced is far higher. The number of movies they've announced that have not been made is far higher than the number of movies that have actually been made.
Yeah,
right?
That is true.
So
yes.
It's okay to not keep this all straight. But my understanding is Mandalorian season four was going to happen. They had finished all the scripts, but they didn't. The strike happened. So they're like, okay, well, now we got to retool this. And maybe some of those / all those scripts will go into this Mandalorian and Grogu movie directed by Jon Favreau. We'll see. Separately, there are also movies in production, one starring Rey, starring Daisy Ridley playing Rey, that takes place after The Rise of Skywalker. That was supposed to be directed by Charmin Obaid-Chinoy. At one point, it had Damon Lindelof working on it. So it seems to have gone through multiple creative cycles. I just heard literally this morning that movie might not be happening via some rumors online or might be delayed. So who knows what's going on with that? There's supposed to be a James Mangold directed movie that takes place in the early, early, early days of the Jedi. And then separately, Dave Filoni is supposed to be directing a movie that brings together the Ahsoka and all the other stuff that's going on in the Star Wars universe. Unclear whether this and The Mandalorian and that are the same movie. I think they are not. I think they're separate movies, and maybe that one will still happen in the future. So yes, so theoretically, there's four different Star Wars movies, of which this one, Mandalorian and Grogu, seems like the most likely one to happen the soonest, right? That's kind of my assessment.
Yes, and also Jon Favreau is he's an efficient filmmaker, right? If you follow the production history of The Mandalorian, to your point, all the report that the scripts for season four were already done, it was always fascinating whenever a new season of The Mandalorian would finish, and then Favreau would do an interview. He's like, oh yeah, I already finished the scripts for the next season. And it's such an interesting contrast to how we've gotten used to how a lot of blockbuster television shows are made these days, where you might go years in between a new season, which is so different than the way television would often be in the past. When I watch a show like Lost, well, it finished in May. Well, the new season will be back in September, just because of the way production has changed. Of course, obviously budgets are different, but if there is, I made the joke about Kathleen Kennedy spinning a Star Wars movie wheel, because you're right. At this point, there are more canceled announced projects than there are movies that have actually made it to any meaningful period of production, which I think speaks to a lot of the challenges. What do you do after the creative disaster that was Rise of Skywalker? What do you do when the legacy of Star Wars is so intertwined with a group of characters and the Skywalker family in particular? How do you move past that? I think those are fundamentally challenging questions that would vex. And it's not like Kathleen Kennedy is new to this. This is a veteran, executive in Hollywood that has, worked across so many different amazing projects over the years. So to find her trying to find a path forward in this is not, I think, super surprising. And this speaks to the challenge of Star Wars as a franchise. But that's all to say, of any of these projects that I think will actually make it into a theater for you and I to watch at some point, I think Favreau's going to get the job done. It seems like the moment you hit the Jon Favreau button is, can we just please get a Star Wars movie into a movie theater? And I really do think it's going to happen. And I think people are underestimating the degree to which Grogu in particular will be, I don't know if that turns into a billion-dollar movie, but that character is still extremely popular. And I think there is a chance for this. Favreau's an extremely skilled filmmaker. I think people also don't really forget that sometimes. He's only directed one episode, I think, or two episodes of The Mandalorian, and the ones in which he's touched as a filmmaker have been excellent. So I actually have a high degree of confidence that this will be a very competent, really fun movie, which is more than you can say of a lot of Star Wars projects at the moment.
Yeah, so you're like excited about that. You're thinking to yourself, "Hey, Mandalorian and Grogu, logical next step would be to have a movie and to see it on the big screen." That would be like that's kind of your overall reaction is like
logical next step. I don't know, except that like it makes sense for the stops and starts that this franchise has had. Like I think the formulaic nature of the Mandalorian makes a lot of sense, where you could tell a one-off movie, whether I don't know how connected this is going to be to what Filoni is doing. I have no idea what sort of weight that like Star Wars is going to put on this film to set up what comes next. But where, without getting into spoilers of where the Mandalorian is as a franchise, where those characters are left the last time we saw them, they can go have adventures and it could be completely inconsequential to setting up, you know, any of the villains from Ahsoka or the other parts of the Star Wars universe. I just think there's a high, like the floor of a Favreau movie is pretty high. I just don't know what the ceiling is. And so I expect this to be like a really good time. And whether it's, you know, transcendent, I don't know, but I don't know if how Star Wars is capable of that these days outside of an Andor.
Yeah, we should also mention that a couple months ago, news broke that Dave Filoni has been promoted to chief creative officer at Lucasfilm. I'm curious what your reaction to that news was, Patrick Lepik.
Well, when you and I were recapping Ahsoka, one of the things I remember pointing out was there are lots of ways to criticize Filoni's approach to filmmaking, to telling stories in Star Wars. But he has a vision. Like, he has a style. I think it's very George Lucas-y. It's for better or worse, but he has a vision and he has an approach. And I think something that Star Wars has been badly missing, it happened a bit in the sequel trilogy and certainly post Rise of Skywalker, is just walk forward. I don't know what's down that path, but just start walking. And there's plenty of reasons that part of what Filoni attempts to do, maybe it doesn't work, but he's got a vision. And at this point with Star Wars, I'd just rather see, go take a whack at it. Like, see what happens. Like, it's a, Star Wars can be anything. And so if for some reason the Filoni stuff falls kind of flat, I mean, there's plenty of easy ways to hit the reset button in a universe that is that flexible.
All right. All that stuff Patrick just said, I want you as a listener to hang on to all that. That's a lot of positivity, a lot of enthusiasm. All right. You know, just cherish and nurture those feelings. Because I'll just say, I thought it was, you know, for me personally, terrible news that Filoni has been put in charge. I have been really unimpressed with everything I've seen. Of which I understand he has masterminded, like Ahsoka. Some great moments, you know, some cool action scenes, didn't hate it, but not what I would say great television or great storytelling. And in fact, frequently laughably terrible storytelling. Dave Filoni, from what I can tell, seems to be somebody who is obsessed with Star Wars past and Star Wars middles, like filling in the gaps between certain things that happen. Very little I have seen tells me that he is a good caretaker for Star Wars' future. To do interesting, bold, new things with the franchise, I've seen nothing that indicates that he's a good person to do that. Andor is an example of something that I think literally will just never get made again under Dave Filoni. Like, it matches nothing of what he has created before. And it is also, in my opinion, the greatest thing that Star Wars has made over the course of the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And even Mandalorian, which a lot of people say, oh, it's like fresh and interesting. You know, it is from what I have seen of the Mandalorian, which is admittedly very little, right? I basically just watched the first season. It has felt to me just as self-referential and just as stuck in the past and interested in kind of rehashing ideas and iconography of the past as everything that's come since then and or accepted. So I, when I heard that he was going to be in charge, my reaction was Star Wars is just not going to be part of my life anymore after Andor season 2, which hasn't come out yet. But like, that's probably going to be the last thing that I really get excited about in the Star Wars universe. And that was really sad for me. You know, so anyway, maybe, you know, you never know what's going to happen in the future. Like, maybe Dave Filoni or Jon Favreau or whoever else is in charge are going to decide, I'm going to take the franchise in a different direction. But nothing I've seen so far indicates that that's the case. And they've had years of chances to try something new and interesting that just hasn't, none of which has materialized, in my opinion. So Mandalorian and Grogu, as for the movie, I understand why they're doing it. I honestly hope it works. Like, it really feels like this is a, it's just, despite everything I've just said, it's sad to see a once great film franchise struggle so badly. Like, yeah, there have been so many aborted attempts at making movies. I'm thinking of Rian Johnson's trilogy that will never happen. It will never happen.
No.
David Benioff and D.B. Weiss were going to make a Star Wars movie at one point. Patty Jenkins released a teaser trailer for Star Wars Rogue Squadron at one point. That movie was supposed to come out, I think, last month, by the way. It's sad to see. I'm old enough to remember when Star Wars came out, like, clear the books. That was going to be the movie event of December of that year. And now they're struggling to even make literally anything. And that's just sad to see. So for the sake of just once great film franchises being restored to their former glory, I hope it works. And it seems like as sure a bet as any. Patrick Lepek, thanks for listening to that mini rant.
I think you reflect where a lot of Star Wars fans are at. And I think the Filoni, again, I don't really celebrate that choice necessarily, but to your point, the creative paralysis this franchise has been under, especially in the last couple of years, especially post Rise of Skywalker, it's less that I think Filoni is going to execute anything particularly interesting, as much as sometimes just do the damn, like, just execute something. Mm-hmm. I'm poking it with a stick.
Just ship something.
Do something. Do something. Like,
where the standards have fallen to, is just get something made, and then we'll go from there.
Star Wars. Like, it's Star Wars. And, you know, I do wonder if the Disney Plusification of everything, which has done terrible damage to Marvel as a brand, in their own production. I think Star Wars has been hurt by, like, hey, we've got a, you know, and it started with the original, like, let's do a Rogue One, let's do a Boba Fett, you know what I mean? Like, just do more. And, like, the single most damaging thing that has happened to Star Wars probably in the last, like, 10, 15 years was do more of them. When the defining aspect of Star Wars over the past 40 years has been they're rare and, like, and it's an event. And the moment you kind of took that away, I do think on some level you started chipping it away at what made Star Wars Star Wars in the first place.
Mm, was like the scarcity was a key component of it. Interesting,
yeah.
Right? I do remember the time before Phantom Menace came out, right? There was all this mystique around it because it was decades, right? It was decades between those movies. And during that time, you know, a whole extended universe sprang up, which, by the way, I think is kind of, It's kind of weird to me, you know. I was talking with my friend Peter Serretta, and I was saying how it's weird that a lot of people are speculating Dave Filoni's movie, not Mandalorian and Grogu, but this other movie that's going to tie together Ahsoka and Clone Wars and all that stuff, is going to be called Heir to the Empire. And Heir to the Empire is a book by Timothy Zahn, which I have read decades, probably when I was in, I don't know, middle school. I read that book, and it was awesome. It was an awesome book. And at one point, Star Wars declared, hey, the extended universe is no longer true. We're calling it something called Star Wars Legends instead. And they kind of erased the extended universe, but now they're bringing back parts of it, basically, which is like Grand Admiral Thrawn is going to be in it probably. And so I just think that's weird. And then my friend Peter responded, well, David, that's why they're called Legends. Maybe they happened. Maybe they didn't. You know, very smart branding. Star Wars Legends, so I thought that was astute. But yeah, Patrick, I tend to agree with you that it is, part of it was that the point I was making was that for all these years, people were just speculating, like, oh, is there ever going to be another one? Like, what's going to happen? And ironically, we have reached that state again, only they've announced like 10 movies, and maybe one of them will be made. So in any case, you mentioned the Disneyification, Disney plusification of Star Wars, and I think what you're trying to say is we are guessing that because Star Wars and Marvel stuff is available so readily at home now on Disney Plus, it makes the theatrical event less special. It makes people less likely to turn out for the theatrical event. Maybe that's true, but it is, I think, worth remarking. These were two of the greatest business acquisitions of all time, Marvel and Lucasfilm. And I do think it's notable that after some really big financial successes, legendary historical financial successes, they're both really struggling right now, right? Like, I think there's not going to be any Marvel movies come out this year other than Deadpool 3.
Yep.
And that is the first time, the fewest Marvel movies that's come out in any year for a really long time.
Since post-COVID, right? So Endgame happens, and then COVID hits, you know, begins the year after, which I believe created like an entire year where there wasn't a Marvel film. But that was by accident, not by on purpose. And this,
there was a, you know, world-altering pandemic.
Right.
This is the fewest number of Marvel films, right? So, and yeah, go ahead. What were you going
to
say?
Well, and here you have the writer's strike also playing an important factor, but you cannot separate. The writer's strike is perhaps ends up being a convenient excuse for a company having to completely rethink its entire creative strategy. At least Star Wars has the advantage of, well, we don't have that much going on, so we can't constantly disappoint you. Whereas Marvel, because the engine is just always moving, it's whatever changes they're making, none of them pay off for years. And in the meantime, it's just, put that other thing out the door that we're not really happy with, and like another round of bad headlines. Like, at least with Star Wars, you cancel a project. Yeah, everyone makes fun of the fact that you can't get a movie out the door, but it's not like a critical commercial failure. It's just a bad series of headlines and blogs and trades. Whereas Marvel just keeps taking body blow after blow.
That is a $100 million loss you're taking if the Marvels doesn't do well or something along those lines, right? So so it's very different. But odds on whether this Mandalorian and Grogu movie are going to happen, Patrick Klepek? I would say 80% plus is my guess, you know? I think they also got to know they've been announcing a lot of these things. And so they got to know, they're like, hey, we actually have to make one of these happen if we're going to keep announcing them, right? So I say 80% plus. What do you think, Patrick?
Oh, no, I'd say 80 to 80.
It sounds like you're like 100%. You're like,
I'm 100%. I think this movie comes out like you have a formula in place. You have actors in place. You've shot versions of this before. You're just doing the bigger one. You know what I mean? Like all the other components, like even the other, like, you know, the Rey led one is falling into a very familiar, like toxic fan base. Like there's just so much going on with these other projects. This one just feels like the reason it was announced, as boring as it might seem, I think boring is the point. Like, this is, we know it's a success. People like these characters. Pedro Pascal is bigger than ever as an actor. You know what I mean? Like, this movie will come at the right time. It'll come around Last of Us season 2. You know what I mean? Like, there are some things in the mix that like are going to benefit this project. So that's why I think it'll happen. I would bet money it'll happen. For me, it's just from a quality standpoint, I know what the floor is. I just don't know what the ceiling is. Yeah. And that's what kind of remains to be seen.
I do have to say, I'm feeling like some flop sweat coming off of Disney Plus these days, you know, like, or the whole like enterprise. I think, you know, part of it snapped into place when they did the Werewolf by Night in color. Do you remember that? Like,
yes.
Michael Giacchino made a Marvel Werewolf by Night. Very good. And then a year later, they said, what if we did Werewolf by Night in color? And it's like, okay, like part of the whole point was that it wasn't going to be in black and white. But, you know, it's like, it almost feels like, as you said, they're spinning a wheel or they're looking around and saying, we got to get a Star Wars movie into theaters. It's been too long. And they're like, well, we have, as you said, we have all the sets. We have the volume and we have the actors and the director is interested. Why don't we put Mandalorian into the, what is stopping us? And they realize that the answer is nothing. So that's what they're doing here. So anyway, I feel like, you know, a little bit of desperation, but maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's all very orderly and in control. Just not the impression I get these days.
I'm inclined to believe the lack of good.
All right. Anyway, those are some thoughts on The Mandalorian and Grogu, the newest movie by Jon Favreau in the Star Wars universe that will hopefully be hitting theaters sometime in the next few years.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Folks, it is time to get to our reviews of recent television episodes. I want to share with people how this is going to work. So every week we're going to talk about some television episodes. This week we're going to talk about Echo episodes 1 and 2. True Detective Episode 1, and Monarch Legacy of Monsters, the finale. I want to let people know what we're going to talk about next week as well, so you can like prepare. People have asked for that. So next week we'll be talking about True Detective Episode 2. We'll be talking about the rest of Echo Season 1. So that's what you can look forward to next week. And we are always open to what your feedback is on this format, how it works. We're going to start by sharing our overall non-spoilery thoughts on each show, and then move pretty quickly into spoilers. I'm also going to play a trailer at the beginning of every conversation. So if you're like fast forwarding, you can kind of find where each segment is. But yeah, we're trying a new thing. We're interested to hear what you think about it. Let us know, decodingtv@gmail.com. Having said all that, Patrick Klepek, let's get into our conversation about Echo episodes 1 and 2.
I see everything that you are. I always have. Don't be afraid.
Patrick Klepek, let's talk about Echo episodes 1 and 2. Episode 1 entitled Chaffa, episode 2 entitled Loak. I will read the description of these episodes from the website that I streamed them at. Episode 1, after her mother's tragic death, young Maya is forced to leave her hometown of Tamaha, Oklahoma, and move to New York City, where she meets Wilson Fisk, aka Kingpin, who raises her to be a ruthless assassin. After learning that Fisk had her father killed, Maya kills Kingpin and flees New York City. In episode 2, Maya enlists the help of her disapproving family to take down Fisk's army. Meanwhile, she begins experiencing strange visions. End quote. So that's what happens in episode 1 and 2. Patrick Klepek, let's start by talking about whether we thought these episodes were good or not and whether you think people should watch them. What do you think, Patrick?
I think it's fascinating. Do you remember what is the new branding that Marvel is attaching, starting with Echo?
Marvel Spotlight. Now, the Marvel Spotlight logo appears on the beginning of every episode. There's a new Michael Giacchino theme that happens when you hear about it. Marvel Spotlight was announced several months ago, and I'm going to read the description of what Marvel Spotlight is.
Uh-huh.
From one of the top Google results for the words Marvel Spotlight. This is from screenrant.com. With the premiere of Echo, Marvel Studios is introducing a new banner, Marvel Spotlight, which will highlight content that does not require background knowledge of the Marvel Cinematic Universe story arcs. And by the way, that sentence was bold. will highlight content that does not require background knowledge. This represents a major shift in Marvel's approach, which through the MCU timeline has been building upon previous movie shows and characters' through lines, most notably in the Infinity Saga arc, which was the franchise's major plot line through MCU Phase 1 through 3, end quote. So, Marvel Spotlight. Interesting that it does not require any background knowledge of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So anyway, you were saying, Patrick Klepek, this extremely standalone, independent story that does not require any background knowledge. Go ahead.
Right. And the other major contrast is all the episodes are dropping at once, right?
Yes.
So you can watch episodes 1 through 5 right away, as opposed to sort of like the weekly event viewing that Marvel or Disney Plus in general has done with their television shows since the launch of Disney Plus and all these Marvel and Star Wars shows have rolled out. I bring all that up because I agree, in theory, that sounds like a really interesting idea to give creative freedom and reduce some of the weight of expectations on every one of these shows. And yet, one of the first messages I got from one David Chen upon beginning to watch this show was, "Hey man, I didn't watch Hawkeye. What the hell is going on in this show?" Because yes, like this show, I think eventually gets to a place where it feels like roughly self-contained in the geography and where it is. It's a rough road getting there to where it can feel like it has established that sort of independence from the broader Marvel universe. I broadly like the shows so far. I think, unfortunately, where I probably land on is that I like what it's trying to do more than I like what it's actually doing. On paper, there are so many cool ideas, the way this like character, like, you know, doesn't speak, like uses like sign language. Like a lot of characters are speaking in sign. Like there are whole arguments, like emotional arcs between characters that are happening, communicated in a way that I just haven't seen in television before, let alone in sort of a superhero story that has to often like be full of bombast and explosion. And like to have to communicate that in this fundamentally different way, I think is cool. The idea of a character that has some sort of supernatural communication history with their ancestors is a unique idea in and of itself. There's like a really cool fight in the middle of the first episode. I just don't know that it all quite can. I don't know where it's like quite going. I'm having trouble emotionally connecting to the arc of Echo as a character. And I did watch Hawkeye. So I've watched everything that Marvel has put out. I am completely up to date, like emotionally, spiritually, physically with everything they've put out. I think mostly it just speaks to some of the convoluted storytelling and choppy storytelling that has defined a lot of Marvel television, which the quality is sort of all over the place. And it rarely feels like it's something all moving on the track in the same direction. And so I think it's such an interesting show, and I guess sort of what I like wish for this show in general is like I don't think they'll ever make a show like this again. Doesn't seem like it doesn't seem like the kind of thing Marvel would probably greenlight in the direction they're going. But I wish it had been in production like 2 years from now, where it's like it really could have been wholly separate from anything. It could have just been conceptualized on its own. Because I think that weight hurts yourself getting into it, and then the first two episodes are like good but not great. And I don't know where the last three will go from there. But how about you?
Yeah, I think as I have, you can kind of tell from my tone, using Marvel Spotlight in this way to introduce this story is, I don't know what the vision for that brand is, but to use it on Echo, I think is ludicrous based on everything I've seen. Like the description I've read of what Marvel Spotlight is, there was a big PR beat around this a few weeks ago where Deadline and Screen Rant and Slash, everyone wrote like Marvel Spotlight is like non-interconnected stories. It's, you don't need any background knowledge. Meanwhile, literally the first 30 minutes is, in my opinion, virtually completely incomprehensible if you have not had some background knowledge of what's going on in Marvel. And so I literally don't even know what they're trying to accomplish. Are they saying Marvel Spotlight is actually different than what they had originally sold it as? Or did they just do a really bad job of launching the first Marvel Spotlight.
I think they're retrofitting something as Marvel goes through sort of a creative crisis, right? Like, this sounds like a key, like, you know, originally when Echo was announced to be a, like, hey, it's going to come out, you know, every week in the same way. It was like, oh, are they burying a bad show? Which is, wow, that's a really bad look for, like, the kind of marginalized characters they are, like portraying in this to be the one that, like, guests were unceremoniously just dumping this one out and giving it a different branding. And so I think there's been a lot of massaging of that message to try and, like, convey, like, no, this isn't, like, a reflect, like, that we don't care about characters like this. You know, Kevin Feige has gone out of his way, you know, be like, I mean, there was a whole PR campaign essentially privately by Disney to, like, throw under the bus a previous executive of theirs. It was like, well, he was kind of a racist and a misogynist and wouldn't let us make characters like Black Perlmutter, right, was the executive. And so I don't – yeah, you're absolutely correct. This is a – I think it does a disservice to Echo as a character. I think it does a disservice to this branding for whatever it's attempting to do, because it really feels like they came up in a corner with a branding and an explanation for a path forward and then just shoved this show into it regardless of whether it actually fits where it might go in the future.
It's very bizarre. And even putting it, let's say I have seen everything in Marvel and I love everything in Marvel. I still think it's a disastrous way to open the show. I still think the way they opened the show was very alienating and bizarre, because they're just showing you scenes from other shows without any explanation. You know, just do a previously on, have a relative do a voiceover, have Maya explain to someone what happened, like, do something. But they're just literally showing random scenes, not random, but like time sequential scenes from from other shows, and like hoping that you will glean enough from them that you can kind of get to where you need to go. And it's bad storytelling. Like, there are ways to catch people up. And we've seen Marvel do variously, you know, do sometimes a good job, sometimes a bad job of catching people up. This is a bad job. They did a bad job catching people up. And there's only 5 episodes in the show. And so 30 minutes of one of the episodes being that bad is like a significant portion of the entire show's runtime. So putting that aside, it's fine. Everything else is fine. And in fact, there is some actually really creative stuff going on in this show. The beginning of episode 2 opens with a scene that happens in 1200 AD of characters playing Choctaw stickball. And it's unlike anything you have ever seen on television before. Mm-hmm. And it's like, wow, like, even if this show just gave me that, that's like a really interesting idea and execution. And so there's some really cool elements about it, but it also feels like it suffers from a lot of what Marvel's TV shows suffer from, which is feels like it needs to be interconnected, and then also ultimately feels like it might be inconsequential depending on what they want to do with the next TV shows and movies, because they can't change the status quo too much. You can't have planet Earth explode or a celestial hand come out of the thing, because you'd have to address it in future movies. Oh, wait. You know what I mean? Like, you can't have, like,
Kingpin can't die. Like, right. I know they're making a new Daredevil show, and I'm sure he is going to be a villain.
Even though theoretically we thought Kingpin died. And that's the other thing, too. It's like, it's connected to, like, 2 versions of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, right? Like, the Daredevil version, which then, like, carried over into Hawkeye, and, you know, and then now the MCU that everyone knows. Anyway, so I think it not only doesn't do anything to assuage concerns about, oh, I need to do a bunch of homework to get into the show, it actively leans into how hard it is, for better or for worse, in ways that I think are actually like really clumsy and counterproductive and unforced errors is what I would describe it as. So those are some overall thoughts. I don't think the show is bad or anything, but the opening is almost catastrophically terrible. And the rest of the show is fine, you know, like, based on what we've seen so far.
Well, you're certainly not going to, there's nothing in that intro to this suggest to you, if this branding in its most idealized form was, look, not everyone wants to stay on the train where they're like keeping up with these interconnected stories, which seem like they're now about to shift more to the films than they are to the television stuff as they kind of like move the dynamic around of how Marvel tells stories in theory. But there's nothing about this show that you would go, well, yeah, I know you don't really like the superhero stuff and you don't keep up with those movies anymore, but like, this show is really interesting and it's only 5 episodes. Some of the episodes are only 35 minutes long. Like, you could just watch this and have a good time and you don't have to care about like what's happening in the Marvels. Like, they do not accomplish, like, there's nothing right. to suggest that, these first two episodes.
If that is the goal, they do not accomplish that, right?
I do I not agree. Think they've accomplished that so far, and I don't get the sense that that's going to happen in the next couple episodes. You know, I can be swayed in any number of directions. Like, I want the show to be good. I'd like it to be better than how I feel about it now, but it doesn't seem like it's, that's a cool idea to have, like, self-contained, yes. or even that. Their own, or even their own little universes, right? Like, in many ways, the Netflix shows became their own little Netflix, they call it, you know, the Netflix, like, Marvel Cinematic Universe, because, like, right. those characters overlapped, and they felt like they were in the same place, but it was small and exciting, and so, like, even when those characters did overlap, it felt, I mean, they worked up to a Defenders, now, the Defenders show was pretty bad, but, like, there is a way you can do that in a smaller pocket, and that's not what's happening here, like, and so, you know, that doesn't fully yeah. accomplish it here, but I'm hoping at least the last 3 episodes contain something, like you said, more scenes, that are novel and interesting and could fit.
You know, I posted about this on Threads, right? Threads, by the way, I have found to be a very terrible experience, because what happens is you post an opinion, and then Facebook/Meta figures out how to serve that opinion to the people who hate that opinion the most, and then you get, like, just inundated with all this criticism of your opinion, and in a way that is much more rapid than it was on Twitter. Like, with Twitter, things would need to marinate for like 12 hours before you start getting like endless bounds of hate. But, but I said on Twitter, on Threads, exactly what I said on this podcast, which is, hey, baffling decision to start this Marvel Spotlight thing with the way they did it. And I got a bunch of people saying, well, I thought Marvel Spotlight was more like, you know, street level stuff as opposed to like intergalactic stake stuff. You're wrong. You're wrong, okay, if that's what you thought. Because, or they didn't message it correctly. Because if you look, I literally read the description from Screen Rant, and many, many other places describe it exactly the same way, which is Marvel Spotlight doesn't require knowledge of the MCU. It's disconnected from everything else. It's not just like lower level stakes or any such shit like that. You're freaking wrong if that's what you thought. Or they did a really bad job getting their PR talking points to everyone when this thing launched a few months ago. One of those is true, but I did not misinterpret what Marvel Spotlight was supposed to be. Arguably, they did. And they made it. All right. Patrick Klepek, let's talk about what actually happened in the episode. Like, is there anything you want to highlight about what happens in the first 2 episodes of the show? It's what's interesting is, like, every episode seems to open at some point in the past, right? And, like, be part of some kind of legend, which I think is just really, like, a cool way to open it. The Choctaw stickball in particular was just like, wow, the way they shot it in ultra wide angle was really, really cool. And I just like, oh, wow, I haven't seen any sports shot like this period, let alone this particular sport that I've never witnessed. So there's some really creative decisions happening. The action is solid, you know, throughout the first 2 episodes. Like, I didn't think it was particularly amazing. Didn't think it was particularly bad or anything. It's just like, hey, these are like really solid down the middle action scenes, one of which is made to look like a long continuous shot, which is kind of a classic Marvel TV show move. The only other thing I want to highlight is Maya is kind of an anti-hero, you know, in a way that I think is rare in MCU stuff. She shoots Kingpin in the eye, thinking that would kill him, because that's a very logical thing. Most people who get shot in the head die. Not all, but most people
I try to avoid it as much as possible.
100%, you know. But that didn't kill him, and so against all odds, he survives, and that's probably going to become a problem. But then the second episode involves her hijacking a cargo train to locate a munitions container and then plant a bomb in one of the crates that she later detonates to kind of flummox Fisk's plans. But she also just kills a bunch of people, right? Like, she just just straight up murders all these dudes, right? And yes, they were bad dudes, and they're probably going to do bad things with the munitions, but she's kind of cold-blooded in a way that I think other Marvel characters aren't. You know, any thoughts on Maya as a character so far, Patrick Klepek?
No, I agree. The most interesting part of her character is, you know, obviously she, you know, the way in which she was removed from this community she was originally was very traumatic. She seems to carry that trauma. She has the way she finds her back home is a lot of people she hasn't seen in literally 20 years as a refrain. Like, this is how you could have had a chance to come back. You became an adult. You could have come back to this community and you chose not to. And that's rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. She meant a lot to this community. And the way in which she comes back and kind of the coldness in which she describes, like, you know, I'm going after Fisk. I don't care if I'm bringing a war, like a literal war, to my hometown, to people I, you know, ostensibly right. care about. You know, I expect.
Yeah, she's gonna learn some. She'll learn some valuable lessons about not bringing a war to your hometown, perhaps. Right?
Yeah, like, there are multiple characters. I'm like, there's some character in particular is like, well, you're clearly gonna die, and that's gonna soften her up, and like, I can see sort of the arc is going here, probably.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Regardless of if that's where it ends up, I'm with you that between kind of like the like historical ancestral legacy they're pulling on. The nature of how they kind of convey her powers, or her ability to survive and adapt, like power adjacent, really, just like how does she move through the world? I think is conveyed like really well, really interestingly. And again, I'll go back to a point from earlier. Like, I'm always fascinated to like whenever we get into an extended dialogue scene, I'm just fascinated to watch how they frame it, how the actors work off one another, because the way they have to convey heightened emotions to one another is just fundamentally different, because the central character like is not going to communicate in the way that like the language of like most characters are going to be in a television or a film. And so it's a unique challenge from like a storytelling point of view. And I think they've found good solutions and interesting ways to convey longer stretches of dialogue in a way that I think could have fallen really flat, or like, because the challenge to them is like, how do we not make this boring? And I think they do a really good job of conveying Echo's emotions. Like, it's really interesting how the entire community around her also speaks to her. Like you can tell they grew up with her, and so they learned how to sign. But I just think all that stuff is really compelling. And I think part of the reason I found myself disappointed by the show is it's such a unique set of circumstances to tell a story. And so the parts where it falls flat feel really disappointing compared to like the set of tools, like the kind of material you're working with, because it's just rare to have a character like this. And so if it's a rare opportunity, do something strong with that storytelling. And I just, it feels like the big story is going to be pretty formulaic from here through five.
I see. So I was going to ask, where does it fall flat for you in kind of the broader story, in your opinion, right?
Yeah, I'm just not sure how interested I am in this war with Kingpin. And I watched Hawkeye, I understand the betrayal. I understand I don't know. It's just that part's not really.
Yeah. Cause
I'd much rather have five episodes of her being awkward back home.
Right.
And none of the Fisk,
none of the Kingpin stuff.
None of the Kingpin stuff needs to be here.
Cause you need to be like, the show relies on you being emotionally invested in, can she best Kingpin? Right. And it's like, even for you as somebody who watched Hawkeye and watched all the other Marvel stuff, it's like that's a hard investment to make at this stage. I think.
Well,
so.
Again, I'm more invested in what is Daredevil going to do with, you know what I mean? Like I didn't get enough time with Echo in the Hawkeye show. I got enough time to be interested in the character. I'm like, oh, I wonder what you could do with this. I'm just not fundamentally all that interested in this arc with her and Kingpin. Even as much as I think Hawkeye and, you know, obviously you don't have the context, but I think they sell pretty well their relationship. Part of that is like, you know, the acting of Kingpin is just like remains fantastic. Such a good actor. Like really fits the character tremendously. But I want a fish out of water story in this town with like all these interesting actors and like this character that has to communicate and move through the world differently. There's tension. You can find tension there. You go find a bully in that town that she has to work with.
Have her
really
solve like a small problem, you know, that's like,
give me a small town. Yeah. A small town tension, as opposed to all those big old problems in New York with Kingpin. I think that if anything, that is still speaking to this broader problem. It's not the world exploding, but it's still that like bigger scale ish, like kind of like conflict that just is not necessary to tell a good story.
Yeah, it's a win-win to do it that way, too, because it probably costs less money, you know? But
yeah.
I do want to give a shout-out to Alakwa Cox, who is the actor who plays Maya. She is a deaf indigenous woman and
first time actor, right?
Had not acted in anything, had not really acted in that much prior to appearing in Hawkeye in 2021, you know, and now she is leading an entire season of television. So just an amazing journey. And it's kind of remarkable that it's a thing that's on television that we can all watch on Hulu right now. So it's worth checking out just because it's something quite different in many ways than what Marvel has done. Other than how disconnected the first disjointed the first half hour feels and also the overall arc of season one. So,
yeah.
Anyway, those are our thoughts on Echo episodes 1 and 2. We'll be back next week to talk about Echo episodes 3 through 5 and finish off this season of television. Let's get to our conversation about True Detective, Night Country, episode 1.
What happened the last case you worked with, Navarro?
That was good. Until it wasn't. Never too late. There was nothing we could do.
I'm working on this new case. A missing scientist. Found on the edge of the villages. Frozen solid.
What do you want?
It's been 6 years. Why are you here?
Because you both know what really happened. And you need my help. I've seen that before. Years ago.
Fine. I'm just gonna do this one thing. Work together to close this case. And that's it for the two of us.
It is.
So you went in or what?
Let's talk about True Detective Night Country episode 1. I'm going to read the plot summary from the episode description. When 8 scientists vanish without a trace, State Trooper Evangeline Navarro tries to convince Police Chief Liz Danvers that the case is connected to the unsolved murder of a local activist. Patrick Klepek. I think this is the most enthusiastic you have been about wanting to cover a show since Twisted Metal. I'm being sarcastic about Twisted Metal. But yeah, you are really into this. I mean, what is your relationship with True Detective? And should people watch Night Country based on what you've seen so far?
Well, it's funny because my enthusiasm for the season has literally nothing to do with True Detective. It's instead the showrunner. Is Issa Lopez?
That is correct. Issa Lopez. Yeah.
One of my favorite horror films of the last 10 years, Tigers Are Not Afraid, is a movie she wrote and directed. It's just a tremendous film. And never in my fucking life would I thought she hasn't done anything. I mean, she's been writing things attached to projects, yada, yada. But like the first thing that she has made since that film is season 4 of True Detective. So when she was announced, it was just because Tigers Are Not Afraid was critically acclaimed. Guillermo del Toro was out there. Like, this movie's amazing. It's an upcoming filmmaker. I was like, what is she going to do next? And I was just confused, curious, interested. Why attach yourself to this project? And so I've just been fascinated for literal years at this point to find out why this, why her, what would bring you to this story. And so with True Detective, I, like a lot of people, adored the first season. Was less frustrated with the end than a lot of people were.
Same. I thought the ending was completely fine.
You know, if you're asking my heart of hearts, do I wish the cosmic horror occurred? Absolutely. I was rooting for that to happen. But I didn't find myself upset that some of the, what is the nature of reality? What is, are there supernatural elements? The lack of any sort of that appearing at the end of that season, I didn't find that to be a disappointment. I thought it resolved very well and was an exceptional season of television. And just lost all interest after that. Like, I watched an episode or two of season 2, didn't do anything for me. As much as True Detective tried to get me back in for season 3, we're like, oh, we're just gonna keep hiring interesting actors. It just was not enough to get me back in. Like, I fell off season 2 so hard that it was hard for me to imagine with the same sort of creative teams in place. I just didn't feel like it had the juice to get me interested again. And so here you have, you know, a really interesting visionary filmmaker coming to make a season of television in which I just wanted to see what they brought to a crime story. It's like so emotionally different than Tigers Are Not Afraid. And, you know, so that's where I arrive at this show. How about you? What is your journey to Night Country?
Yeah, pretty much the same. You know, True Detective season one, I thought was just a home run. Thought the ending was fine. Then completely fell off the show in True Detective season two. Got like 1.5 episodes in True Detective season two, and thought, you know, I don't need to do this. Nick Pizzolatto, the creator, has admitted he didn't have enough time to write season two, and so it really showed. And never got back on the train for season three, but this season has two really interesting lead actors. Jodie Foster, kind of in Silence of the Lambs modes. Callie Rice, who is a former boxer turned actor. And that's just like an interesting combination.
Huh.
A lot of people are saying that this is like a mirror image of season one of the show. Instead of the hot and humid South, it's in literally one of the coldest places on Earth. Instead of two male leads, it's two female leads. And, you know, it's going to probably, for that reason alone, it's really interesting to see how the show may or may not be echoing earlier seasons. So I was already kind of interested based off of who's the talent involved. Issa Lopez, I haven't seen any of her work, but I've heard great things. And so I was already kind of interested. Then the reviews started pouring in and they were really rapturous. And so I thought, hey, we got to do this thing. So yeah, let's talk about episode one. You know, did it live up to what you were looking for, Patrick Lepik?
Yeah, I am like completely other than, okay, the introductory shot to this show with some not particularly great visual effects for, I think, some caribou, I believe, are the animals running around. That felt a little, but whatever. Broad strokes, I'm all in. I love the central mystery that is set up. I love the world. I love the like bits we've gotten in about the community and the history that everyone has. Like, it's a small town. Like, clearly a lot of bad things have happened here, are going to happen here. Jodie Foster is awesome. She's just not an actor we see all that much of these days. Seems very selective.
She was in the Netflix movie Naiad, and she was really good in that. You know, that was just here.
Right, that just happened recently, right? But you know, but someone that you're not, she's not acting all the time, selective with projects. And so whenever I see her again is a delight. And so to have her in this horror mode again, or horror adjacent, you know, it's kind of unclear how far we're going to go, which is part of the fun. Because I think a lot of what's really beautiful and fun about this season is that I think it probably works completely fine if you have no connection to True Detective whatsoever, right? Yes. You have no sense of the themes, like what ideas it was playing with in the first season.
It's the Marvel Spotlight's Echo.
In that way. It is clear that it is well aware of what season one was doing. Mm-hmm. And it is well aware of the ideas it was playing with, the kind of fanciful and at times like fun ways it was like playing with, what are we watching? How far could this world go? It is, again, it rewards if you've seen season one from like a big picture thematic sort of feeling and the ideas it was playing with. But it isn't necessarily like, hey, we're going to pay off existing lore. At least I don't think so. I don't think that's the direction that it's going. And I just love the tone. Like, it is just ominous and upsetting. And like the little sequence where someone like runs across the screen really fast. And I'm like, I don't know where this is going. It's an all time great closer shot. Like, the way the episode ends is just my God, I have to know like what's happening next. And you were very kind. I told you it took every fiber of my being to not hit play on the second episode. Like, should we record our conversation early so you can watch? I was like, no. I will be one with the masses, and I will wait until the second episode. But yes, I think I am all in, all on board. I think it's an amazing first episode of television that just has me on the edge of my seat to see what's next.
Yeah. For the record, Patrick and I have access to the episodes early, but we do not watch ahead. That's a thing that we don't do because we don't want to give hints about what might happen in the future. So we are
waiting too. Like, I love. I'm a huge actual literal fan of the wait between an episode as opposed to being able to watch them all at once. I think
interesting. I don't feel the same. I wait because I have to.
No.
I think it will make for a better podcast. You know, that's why I wait. So I agree with you, Patrick. I think it's a really solid opening episode. One of the things I love the most about it is the sense of place. This is happening in Ennis, Alaska, and you really feel like the show does a good job of capturing what the small town vibe is there. Everyone knows each other. People have problems, many of which are related to the fact that they live in Ennis, Alaska. and so it does a great job of capturing place, which is something that I think is a core part of what makes True Detective an anthology series. One of the unifying ideas behind the series is like, we need to capture this like location in a really interesting and compelling way. So let's talk about some of the stuff that happens in the episode. Anything specifically stick out to you? There's this mystery of this woman, you know, Trooper Evangeline Navarro believes Anne Kotok, who's a indigenous woman who was stabbed to death and had her tongue cut out, is because she's protesting a local mine, that murder, which is unsolved after 6 years, is related to this disappearance of these researchers. I like that you get a sense of how good of a detective Jodie Foster's character is really quickly. John Hawks is like a ticking time bomb, I think, because she just has no compunction about humiliating him over and over again. And so I just feel like he's going to snap at some point. My wife and I were debating, do we think that we're going to the plot line or the timeline of the show is going to make it so that we actually see what happens with John Hawks's mail order bride at some point this season? I think it's likely that plot will, I don't know if we'll see that character, but I think it's likely that plot will get resolved or moved along meaningfully this season, is my guess. And that it will likely be resolved in such a way that it further emasculates John Hawks based on how the season has been going. John Hawks plays one of Jodie Foster's characters, kind of underlings. And mm-hmm. I thought the relationship that John Hawks' son had with Jodie Foster was really interesting. You know?
Yeah.
He clearly has more of an affinity for her than for him, and mm-hmm. you know, looks up to her more, and yet another way in which John Hawks' character is humiliated. But yeah, like there's a lot of really interesting character dynamics. Navarro, you meet some of Navarro's like loved ones, and this dude she sleeps with in like a kind of upsetting sex scene, you know, that she has with this guy. So yeah, there's like a lot of this little like color of like what these people's lives are like that I thought was very effectively done. Patrick, anything stick out to you about the first episode?
Yeah. It's really the sense of place, right? Yeah. I think this does a really great job, like you said, not just establishing the kind of ways in which these lives are intertwined, overlapped by necessity. Like there's just not that many people here. The geography does not span that far. You don't have a choice. Your lives are going to intersect. And I think that part is really well done, but also just the oppressive feeling of like it feels tight. Like you can just like feel like the darkness is overwhelming. It's a place that they're in by circumstance, not by choice. And you can imagine that sort of tension is going to play itself out over and over the course of the show. And I think it leads itself to a good place where I don't know. We don't know much about the central mystery yet, right? Like some people died under strange circumstances, and you can start doing some theorizing. But it's exciting that what I'm most interested in the show so far is not necessarily like, I better start theorizing about this core murder. It's spending a lot of time making these character dynamics work and be interesting. So that I'm sure by the time as we move forward in the show and the core mystery takes over, you get all that payoff from these characters. And I think these core characters are really good. And as having a director that, you know, comes from horror, like understands tension. I mean, I think you see that play out over and over in like there are so many scenes that even when they're not overtly scary, just I don't know, like are just kind of tense. Like they're just shot in a way that you can tell you have someone that understands the genre that they're playing in. And I think it does a really good job of establishing that tone. And then again, like I said, the payoff at the end where all the heads stuck in ice is just an incredible piece of imagery.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And you know, places a lot of details as how characters interact. It's also just like physically how things look. I thought the research station looked, hey, that seems like what I imagine a research station might look like.
And, yeah.
And really makes you feel how oppressive living in a place like this might be. But also you can kind of see part of why people might want to do something like this, you know, that there is some appeal to something like this. There is a really interesting subplot where this woman named Rose, who lives on the town's outskirts, is the one who discovers the bodies because she's led there by a mysterious apparition, question mark, who we of unknown provenance. We don't know who Travis is at this point. We don't know if he's related to her, I don't think, or if they were married or whatever. But I think that's probably going to come into play at some point as well. We'll see about that. So, yeah, it definitely is an episode that sets up some really interesting central mysteries, that sets up some really interesting character dynamics. Anything else you want to mention about True Detective Night Country episode one?
Just in general, I want to watch the second episode, but from folks that have already, you know, like the screeners going out, you could watch the whole season if you're a critic and if you have access.
There are
going to
be six episodes, I believe, of this season. Yeah.
The vibe I've gotten from some, like multiple people have said this, was like, there's going to be a moment in it's essentially the beginning of the second episode. Like, there's going to be a moment where this show asks, are you on board? Like, are you ready to keep going? I don't know what it is. I have no idea what that means, but there's some sort of, it was described as gnarly. And there's like a gnarly thing that happens essentially fairly early in the second episode. That's like, hey, you ready? Are you going to keep walking down this show? And I'm like, I know, I don't need to be asked. I know. I mean, that's just revving me up even more. But I'm excited to see, because the way folks have talked about it is that it's not just a show with like a bunch of gnarly horror, but like it is combining that with a good core story and mystery. And to have that just be six like tight episodes is just, that's really exciting. I'm just very curious to see it all play out.
And that I think, hopefully we'll have something to say about modern society and how we handle, you know, for instance, the murder of indigenous women, you know, and things of that nature. And so we'll see. I don't know. We haven't seen any more episodes, but I'm curious. I'm really excited. I think episode one was really solid. And I am excited to see these two actors go at it for the rest of the season. I think they have a really interesting, tense dynamic that I have a feeling they're going to develop a mutual appreciation of each other, Patrick. You know, I'm just guessing. Anyway, that's True Detective Night Country episode one. And we will be discussing episode two next week. All right, Patrick Klepek, let's get to our final episode that we're going to cover today. That is the season finale of Monarch Legacy of Monsters.
Monarch was there in San Francisco. When the whole city was coming down, these guys were taking pictures like they'd been waiting for it.
You think that your father was working for them?
This stuff wasn't as safe.
Who are they? What's Monarch?
There's a new welcome.
This is the world we live in. Monsters are an inescapable reality. And it's so strong.
Those files belong to us, and they are more important than you could possibly imagine.
Patrick Klepek, let's talk about the season finale of Monarch Legacy of Monsters. I'm going to read the plot summary from the description of the episode. The team struggles to find a way out of Axis Mundi while Kentaro and Tim make an unexpected alliance. I want to confess, I have not seen the entire season of Monarch Legacy of Monsters, but I did watch this episode, so we would have some mutual point of reference for talking about it. But Patrick Klepek, why don't you tell us what you thought about this season of television and what you thought of this finale?
Well, in the previous iteration of this podcast, you know, you and I sit and talk about different shows we're like mutually interested in, or one we want to pitch
other. It to you. I had said to you, maybe we should cover Monarch Legacy of Monsters week by week. I had said as an option.
The reviews of the season were like, I think both kind of took us by surprise. We're like generally positive and like, hey, this is a surprisingly good season of television. And so you pitched me on it. I was like, how many episodes is it? It's like 10. I was like,
yeah,
there's
okay, I know these reviews are good. And look, I'm a mark for a show like this. Like, Godzilla's one of my favorite characters, but, and I even like all the stuff that Legendary has been doing over the series of their films, but like, 10 episodes? Like, David, I am not going to do this to you. There is not a chance I'm going to take you through 10 episodes of Monarch Legacy of Monsters. And I was very skeptical that the show could really justify like 10 hours each. You know, most episodes are roughly an hour long, a little less. And what I'll say is it does not justify to 10 hours. Really, it's you know, our discussion about True Detective, that's 6 episodes. I really wish this had been 5 to 6 episodes mm-hmm. of television. I think this show has a lot of really cool ideas. It tries to swing past being more than just a Dave Filoni like filling in lore mm-hmm. holes from previous films or retconning for the sake of setting up future storytelling. The core thesis of this show, I think, is looking at the way a lot of like Western Godzilla films are made, which is to then just like set it in America, like forget the fact that like the origins of like what mm-hmm. made Gojira like an interesting and compelling story about like post-war Japan, post-bomb Japan. And it just forgets all that stuff so it can get to the big green monster
right,
and it
right.
can stomp around. And that's true of even Gareth Edwards' Godzilla film, which I consider to be one of my favorite blockbusters of the last 15 years. I fucking adore that movie. I think all the human stuff is very flimsy, but the filmmaking around Godzilla itself is like some of the most terrifying imagery I've seen. I should point out, I still have not seen Godzilla Minus One. I'm supposed to see that this weekend.
Amazing movie.
And I know that movie has a really good sense of...
It's my number three film of 2023.
Yeah. So, yeah, my guess is it would land like that for me when I get around to seeing it this weekend. And the show, I think, looks at that legacy of how this character has been treated, even in these legendary produced movies, starting with Godzilla, and the next one is supposed to be Kong X, but I forget the actual titling of it, but it's the new Kong Godzilla film, The New Empire.
Godzilla X Kong, The New Empire.
The New Empire, yes. Which is a terrible title. The movie's probably gonna be a blast though. And it's this movie really sits with like a bunch of Japanese characters and like tries to like intertwine their histories for them in the storytelling. And there's just not enough there. It's extraordinarily flimsy. There's not enough depth. Unfortunately, like some of those interesting, the structure of the season is split into. There's stuff in the present, which is these characters dealing with what is called G-Day in the history of this version of Godzilla, which is when Godzilla appears in 2014 in San Francisco, as depicted in the Gareth Edwards film. And this mysterious organization Monarch that kind of like deals with tracking these events and what's happening. And then, so the show is these characters dealing with the aftermath of that attack and, specifically their father, who is like mysteriously intertwined with Monarch and how that fits into their family's legacy. A word they say so many times in this show, like, this is your legacy. Just take a drink every time they say legacy in the show, legacy. And then that is contrasted with more of a period piece, which is the origins of Monarch and the origin of discovering what they call the Titans, which are Godzilla and Mothra, King Ghidorah and all of these kind of like, you know, classic monsters that we know from Godzilla history. And that story is so much more interesting than everything happening in the modern day. Mm-hmm. And we spend so much time in the modern day. The only thing that works in modern day is Shaw, where we have Kurt Russell just luxuriating in the fact that he's in like a Godzilla show. Just yeah. Hamming it up, having a good time. He's tremendous.
He was paid many millions of dollars to appear in the show.
Well, he's also in it. There's also a novelty factor that he is playing the older version of a character his son is playing. So,
which is really cool. That's like really cool. And that, because it's rare to see a show that does that, where you can have a guy's son play the younger version of him. Honestly, the last time I can remember it happening was The Many Saints of Newark, when James Gandolfini's son plays right. younger version of James Gandolfini, but obviously he has already passed on. So it's cool that they're both in the same show at the same time, you know?
Yeah, and Wyatt Russell is, you know, an actor I quite like, and I think he's pretty good here. I think this show just buckles under a core premise that doesn't have enough to it and yeah. is betrayed by a 10 episode 1 hour running time.
Right.
It has a bunch of cool ideas, and there is just not enough runway, and you don't see the Titans all that often, you know, big shock. Like Godzilla is very expensive to produce. So then the show has to rely increasingly on these characters and their journey making sense. And I just much rather would have preferred a 5 to 6 episode show that was completely set in the past, that was completely disconnected from any of the modern day storytelling, and was just, what is it like to discover these creatures and the methods they use? All that stuff is really interesting and fun, and the character dynamics are good, and the characters they have it set in modern day just I had trouble connecting with. All that said, I did quite like the finale. It actually it pays off your investment. It just took a long time to get to that moment, and it's a little frustrating along the way to get to these emotional beats and these emotional payoffs. I think those payoffs do pay off. I was like, turned to my wife, was like, she's like, are you crying? I was like, yeah, I'm crying at a Godzilla show. Shut up. Like, I realize how absurd that sounds, but
get ready to cry during the Godzilla movie as well.
I know. That's what I've heard. Yeah. Doesn't take that much for Patrick to cry, so let's not pretend it's a high bar to get me over the edge. But I think the emotional payoffs are good. I like. I think it's interesting where the characters end. I am hopeful there is a season two, but I'd love if that season two was more constrained, more focused, and so, you know, understanding what the show can do and can't do, which is it can't have giant fights all the time. And so you have to have storytelling that means something
right.
with these characters. And I really do think they tried. I just do not think there was enough meat on those bones to survive the running time. But for someone that was wildly out of context, I am fascinated to learn if you took anything out of this hour of television.
Well, I watched the first couple episodes of the show months ago, and I thought to myself, you know what? This is not really for me. I'd heard all these great reviews, and I was thinking to myself, I'm already kind of seeing the cracks in this thing.
Yeah.
What I mean, which are basically what you just described, that it feels like there is a lot of plot or not very much plot that they're trying to stretch out. And that is also evident in this episode, when I feel like I had the same plot point explained to me, I think, three separate times in three separate scenarios, where it just feels like it's characters repeating exposition a lot and saying like, we got to go do this thing. And it's actually almost comical, because oftentimes the dialogue is very uninteresting and expository, and just they blast this very creepy atmospheric music in the background. And I was thinking to myself, if they just took away this music, it would look and sound kind of ridiculous what these characters are saying. And so I think my decision to not like watch the entire show was justified. Having said that, it's always a delight to see Kurt Russell in anything. And so it was, he was wonderful in this show, explaining, you know, and of course the big moment, so we're going to spoil the episode, right, is when he meets Keiko for the first time after he has aged decades.
So good.
But she has only aged like 2 months. And that is an extremely powerful scene. Obviously the highlight of the episode. And
all those beats pay off. Again, I think it's a show that is very long in the tooth, but the time spent with those characters makes that moment pay. Like, I'm glad that you could at least get like
right.
just through the sheer acting, you can get
probably
a sense.
I got like 70 to 80% of the goodness.
Yeah,
maybe
one might say that very well might be true. A little bit what you miss is like what happens with like the modern day characters and the reveal
right.
that like you're meeting your granddaughter who is like a, you know, of age, like 20 something. And I just like all that stuff landed really like in a completely over the top goofy world of like jumping into holes that transport you to a, different dimension or a hollow earth. There's actually this, the legendary verse of the, like, has different names for different parts of how all this stuff works. I don't think they ever say hollow earth in this one, even though that's the conclusion they draw in the last Godzilla versus Kong film. But I wanted more of that. It's like once when they the moments they pull off in the end there, it's like, okay, you can do this. It is possible to do this kind of storytelling in this hyper exaggerated world and distanced away from these giant CG creatures, but that's difficult to do. And they didn't get to those moments enough. And it felt like two shows. It really did feel like there were two shows in here, and that's the only way they could justify 10 episodes at an hour each. And it would have been better if it was one of those shows set in the past and then like concluded with the present day stuff to tie it all together into the modern films that they're making. But I think go ahead.
The resolution of the episode where they finally go back and Kurt Russell lets go of the pod and maybe he's dead, but you don't see him dying. So I think they could
depends
still bring
him on back. If Apple's going to write a check for season two.
Exactly. Right. I thought it was all fine. The thing that was confusing was at the very end, they show up at the place and one of the characters says, it's actually been 2 years. And all the characters are like, what? And my reaction was, why didn't you see that coming? Like, you clearly were in a place, you clearly were in a location that slows down your experience of time. So why is it surprising to you that 2 years have passed? Like, I literally just started watching the show and I seem to have more of an understanding of how time works than you do. It's stuff like that that I'm like, I think it was a good idea for me not to like invest in the show. Anyway,
no, David, I spared you. I did you a kindness by saying, I have suspicions this will not justify itself. And you would have been
insufferable.
If I wanted to hurt you, like, and maybe I should go back into the hollow earth pipe, come out a different pipe, and go, David, you need to watch all 10 episodes of this, because it would have been entertaining in a morbid sort of way. But no, you would not have had a good time. I had a really good time. And it's interesting because Apple has a series of mediocre, extremely expensive sci-fi shows. Like, that's kind of their thing. Like, I know For All Mankind is
generally regarded as actually good. Yep.
As actually good. You have Foundation, which is like supremely expensive and I don't think it's supposed to be very
good.
Apparently
season two was good, but most people didn't make it to season two is a fact. You know,
you have Invasion, an alien invasion show that looks very expensive. And I don't know anyone that's watching that.
I literally have not spoken to a single person.
Well, it just got ready for season three, so don't worry about it. Whatever Apple exec is just taking all that iPhone money and going, I love mediocre sci-fi, and I'm going to spend so much money making it. And Monarch slots into that, in which I'd never recommend it to you, but I love Godzilla stories so much and cannot get enough of them, and like enough of the world building in this little the Legendary's take on this that started with Godzilla and has gotten more absurdist over time. I was happy to spend like 10 mediocre hours in a beautifully realized version of that, even if I ultimately wish the storytelling was better.
Yeah, indeed. Any other thoughts on the season finale of Monarch: Legacy of Monsters, Patrick Klepek, or shall we wrap it up there?
Look, if Invasion's getting a season three, you sons of bitches better give me a season two of this. I hope they do a season two. I think there's an interesting setup for the future. I love, King Kong appears at the end. This appears to be set after Godzilla, but pre King of the... Now I'm getting into the lore of the Legendary Monster movies, so maybe I'm going to completely lose David here. But I'm in. I would watch a second season happily. I just hope that the storytelling would get a little more focused, because I think that's where they kind of lost the plot, was a literal lack of a plot in this season.
Got to give a shout out to Mary Yamamoto, I believe, who plays Dr. Keiko. Her performance really
She's good.
Tied the whole episode together.
Yeah.
And I realize I say that as someone who hasn't seen the whole show, but it's the fact that I still felt something means that the sheer acting talent was there. Anyway, that's Monarch: Legacy of Monsters. All right, folks, we hope you have enjoyed this new format of Decoding TV. We'd love to hear what you have to say about it. Let us know at decodingtv@gmail.com. Find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com and find us across all platforms at Decoding TV. We got one last segment for you we're going to do. Going to be pretty quick. It's going to be our reactions to your reactions to the Curse. Curse season finale, series finale. So stay tuned for a couple minutes for that. But before we do that, Patrick Klepek, you want to let people know they can find more of your work on the internet this week?
Yeah, you can find me talking about video games, sports, home repairs over at remapradio.com. My newsletter, Crossplay, about parenting and gaming is at crossplay.news.
All right. So, Patrick Klepek, we recorded last episode about The Curse. Great conversation with Jesse Earle. We did that, like, it was released right after the episode came out. We have since had a week to process a lot of the reactions to the episode. And I guess I just wanted to see if there's anything you saw that changed your mind or, you know, made you think differently about it. I will say I would characterize the reaction to The Curse finale as very polarized. There was a bunch of people that thought this was awesome, this is great, and probably about half of the people thought this is terrible. I think it is actively bad and does not honor what the rest of the show set up. But I'm curious, Patrick, any reaction to kind of the reaction to The Curse?
I think one of my favorite moments was talking to a buddy of mine who had asked, like, oh, are you watching the show The Curse? And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, it's pretty cringy and funny. Like, you know, I don't know. He's like, well, I'm going to wait and see how it ends before I jump in. And so then when it ended, I asked, I'm begging you, stay off the internet when, like, the finale hits. I don't think the discourse will last that long, but, like, you might get astray and you don't want to know anything about what happened.
Absolutely.
So you could go in fresh. And then my buddy is like, okay. So he missed all that. And then over last weekend, he's like, I sat down to watch the show. I made it 10 minutes before I realized there's not a fucking chance I'm going to make it through the rest of the show. The cringe was just too much. Yeah. I could not handle it. And I was like, well, it gets worse from there. So if you're going to bail. I was like, but can I spoil the ending for you? He's like, absolutely. So I explained the ending. And I was like, right. So then they have a baby at the end. And then halfway through, he wakes up on the ceiling because gravity has reversed. And then, like, while she's having the baby, like, they try and cut him down from a tree, but he goes into space and dies. And there's just a long pause. And it's just like, blank is typing in Discord. And the response was, well, I guess I'm missing some context. And I said, no.
No, you're not. Yeah. I want to read a couple comments at decodingtv.com that I think are pretty interesting. Shane left a comment at decodingtv.com that was just blew my mind. You know, Shane writes, quote, what struck me was how Asher's final moments mirror how his son must have felt as he was being born. Asher waking up to find he's upside down could be a reference to how his son was born, Breach. Asher's panicking and screaming while the firefighter saws into the tree branch. Then we quickly cut to the delivery room where his son, who is probably similarly panicked, is being cut out of Whitney's womb. After the C-section, we see the doctor holding up Asher's son so he's contrasted against the blue curtain, much like how Asher's contrasted against the blue sky as he hurtles upwards. The show ends with both of them being violently and traumatically lifted into a place that is infinitely colder and more vast than anything either of them are used to. Maybe this is the show's way of saying that we are all cursed by our parents to live through the horror of being born into this effed up world, only to suffer briefly before we finally shake loose the mortal coil. Or maybe it's just a clunky metaphor for how guys like Asher tend to fail upwards. Who is to say?
Well, also someone pointed out, maybe this is in the Decoding TV comments or just something I saw on social media, but that, you know, Asher's comments in his speech to Whitney in the penultimate episode of like, I'll know when you don't want to be with me anymore and I'll know it and I'll just disappear. And he sort of, that's sort of what, you know, it's kind of, yeah, there's definitely a reading of the episode that she decides she's done with him and like, oh, he felt it, like literally his body felt it and said goodbye.
Yeah. There's a lot of speculation, including in that comment, I think, like, or that the comment presupposes that, like, maybe Asher is being reincarnated as his son in some way, or like the son being born and him being into this, like, thrown into the sky is like some parallel process. And you know, earlier on in the episode, he's pointing at her belly and he says, there's a little me in there, you know, there's a little me in there. And she kind of has this look of horror on her face. I do want to say one thing that I wanted to kind of correct of myself, which is, you know, I was saying how we didn't really have much interiority in Whitney's character, and Jesse kind of disagreed with me on the episode. And I think Jesse was right, basically, because if you rewatch the finale and just study Whitney's face, it's clear that there is a deadness in her eyes that is meant to make you feel like she is not happy. I think that's what is implied. And so,
yeah,
yes, she kind of agreed to Asher's play of like, yes, let's give this relationship a chance or whatever. But at the end of the day, she's still not happy and doesn't feel like she can be herself and reveal the truth to Asher. And maybe when she finally has the baby and Asher's no longer there, she finally feels like she can be herself, right? She finally feels like she can say what she actually thinks, which is in some ways a horrible thing that she actually thinks, you know, which is that she kind of doesn't like her husband very much. There was a question from Banana Joe who wrote in, I don't get why it's a problem that they gift the house to Abshir. I'm not in a financially bad situation, but I would be forever thankful to anybody who gifts me a house. And I wrote that there's nothing bad about that inherently. The question is, why give a gift at all? If it's truly something that comes from a spirit of generosity, the recipient's reaction would not be important. But for the main characters, Abshir's reaction is what's most important. Also, David, separate David, commented at decodingtv.com, Abshir is presumably in a much more precarious financial situation. Owning versus renting a home has significant advantages and disadvantages. There's a lot written on this topic, and for many, renting is actually more beneficial than owning. For example, Abshir's awareness is demonstrated by his questions about property taxes, which renters are not responsible for. Anyway, I thought that was a great point about how giving someone a house might in some ways be more burdensome for some people than you would think. But the other point is just that, in my opinion, you know, I think it was Maimonides who said, like, the only true gift is one that is anonymous, you know? And I really feel that way. Like, if you really have a generous spirit of giving to someone, then it does not matter what their reaction is to it. But clearly Asher and Whitney were really focused on, as with the entire series, focused on what people's reaction is to their generosity. And that is the tell that they are not truly generous.
They filmed it.
Yeah, they filmed it, right.
Secretly.
Exactly. Secretly. There you go. There you go. I'm trying to figure out anything else that brought up, you know, some people pointed out that the final shots of the show are the only shots that were not shot like documentary or voyeuristic style, you know, the final shots, like moving through the city, moving into the house, were kind of like on Steadicam or dolly, basically. It felt like they were, you know, and everything else was, you know, in a car or on a tripod or something like that. And maybe it's to indicate that, you know, those shots, you were looking at those from the perspective of the curse or something, you know, something like that. But I did think it was worth noting that those shots were different than all the other shots. Anything else come up, Patrick Klepek, that you thought was an interesting reaction to the show?
No, it was just a delight to watch it all happen. I was just so excited for everybody, you know, in good ways and bad ways. But it was like one of those rare instances where we'd seen it before you, and then you just get to watch the magic happen. And so, you know, and then, you know, reading a lot of the critical analysis that, you know, most of the ones that I ended up reading fell in line with, I think, where you and I were like, huh, an interesting piece of filmmaking, but a poor piece of storytelling to conclude this saga. I found that to be cathartic to read that written by like multiple extremely talented critics that could convey that much more elegantly than I can. It was like, ah, thank you for putting into words how I felt about this episode. But, you know, I still feel same way that we talked about. Like, I'm glad they took a wild swing. I actually think it's a show, despite my disappointment with how it wrapped up, I will probably appreciate more with time for just how strange.
You were really negative on it. And I was thinking to myself, hey, I think, yeah, time will vindicate this show, I think, because it's such a big swing and it's just so rare to see anything like that on television, you know? And I think history will judge the show positively because of how big the swing was. I think a lot of the negative reaction is a result of people's disappointment that stuff they thought was going somewhere didn't go anywhere, right?
Yeah.
Asher's penis and that whole situation, like, oh, was that ever going to add up to anything? Not particularly, unless you think it ties in with, you know, what happens with him at the end. Fernando's proclivity for open carry. The guy, the Ripper character who was in the thing, you know, who was in the house. Like, I undersold how many plot lines didn't even get mentioned at the end.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people are expecting this to be like a standard Decoding TV show that is covered, which is, oh, it sets up a bunch of stuff and then it, you know, resolves most of it. And this show obviously wasn't interested in doing any of that. So I think, you know, the most convincing criticism I heard of the show, actually, Patrick Klepek, is that because it doesn't resolve any of those plot lines, none of those characters or plot threads feel consequential in any way. They are merely plot devices or things that motivate the main two characters. And that feels a little bit cheap in a show that theoretically is about how oblivious white people are. And so that is a somewhat convincing critique of like, yeah, what happened to Abshire? Like, and we don't even get to say goodbye to his daughters at all. On you know, like, there's no goodbye for those characters at all. They're just like, oh, they're not here. You know, so really the whole show is just filtered through their perspective, through the perspective of Whitney and Asher, and for good or ill. You know, for good or ill. And I think you can have a lot of positive and negative things to say about that. So anyway, I want to thank everyone for their reactions and writing into us at decodingtv@gmail.com, commenting at decodingtv.com, hitting us up on social media. It was a memorable TV show, and we appreciated talking about it here on Decoding TV with you all. Let us know what you think of the new weekly format. Until next week. Usually we'll try to be out on Tuesdays. Next week we might be a little bit delayed by a day or so because I'm going to go to Sundance, and so that's going to mess with my schedule a little bit. But yeah, hope to see you all next week for another episode of Decoding TV. He's Patrick Klepek. I'm David Chen. Goodbye.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.